Okay, so what does the protein coding gene code for? What? No. I mean, not really. What does a protein coding gene code for? Anyone? Any of you? Can't hear you. Can't hear you. No, I'm talking about what it actually codes for, not the process it's involved in. Okay, what is a protein coding gene? No.
mRNA?
What is it?
mRNA?
Right. A protein coding gene codes for how to make messenger RNA. What does a non-protein coding gene code for? So you're convincing yourself once again that it would be a good idea to wait until the end to study for this stuff? You're satisfied with your grades up to now on the exams? You can be if you're allowed to be. But you have to review this stuff nightly as it happens. Don't put it off. Anyone come up with the answer yet?
So, not instructions for making proteins, but the control of gene activity?
No. A non-protein coding gene does not do that. What did we just say a protein coding gene codes for?
RNA.
And what process results in that?
Transcription.
Okay. Genes in general get transcribed. What does a non-protein coding gene get transcribed into? When a non-protein coding gene gets transcribed, what is produced? No. DNA gets produced in DNA replication, which is the other function of DNA, right? We're talking about transcription now. When a protein coding gene gets transcribed, what is produced is messenger RNA. When a non-protein coding gene gets transcribed, I'll give you one more chance. Some other kind of RNA besides messenger RNA. That's the difference. Messenger RNA is the specific kind of RNA whose job it is to code for a polypeptide. And that's why the gene that codes for messenger RNA is a protein coding gene, because not only will it be transcribed, but then that messenger RNA will be translated into a sequence of amino acids to produce a polypeptide. So the gene indirectly codes for a protein. But messenger RNA is only one of many types of RNA. And the cell has to be told how to build any kind of RNA molecule. So to make any of the other kinds of RNA, some of which we'll be talking about, any kind other than messenger RNA, requires a non-protein coding gene, because when it gets transcribed, it's not going to produce messenger RNA, and that's not going to go on to translation. It's going to produce just another kind of RNA for its own sake. You see the difference now? Okay. Let's go then to slide 2 and focus on the protein coding genes for the rest of the chapter. And by the way, of your genes, the vast majority are protein coding genes. The non-protein coding genes are important because you need those other kinds of RNA that they code for, but the vast majority of your genes are protein coding genes. And do you have a feel for how many you have? Of course, the number of protein coding genes depends on species, but do you have a feel for how many it is for humans? This is something we didn't know until fairly recently when we did the Human Genome Project. Actually, it's been a couple decades already, but still fairly recently. Roughly 20,000 human genes, which surprised the hell out of us. We thought it was going to be a much, much bigger number than it actually is. So, for any of these protein-coding genes, there is a process called gene expression. Gene expression does involve the gene, but actually only for part of it. Gene expression is the phrase given to the process of reading the information in a gene and then going through the two processes in order of transcription and then translation. Transcription first and then translation. And since we're talking about protein coding genes, that means transcription produces messenger RNA. And that first process, transcription of the two, is the only one in which DNA is directly involved. So the gene, which is the DNA, is involved in transcription, and it's involved in the first part of gene expression. But gene expression refers to more than just what the gene is doing. To express a gene, though, means to turn it on so that it can be transcribed. If it's not transcribed, the gene is just there like a book on a shelf. It's not being used at the moment. But turn it on, transcribe it, which means to store the code that DNA in the gene is holding in the form of a messenger RNA molecule. That's what transcription is all about. DNA's job is done at that point, but gene expression involves, after that, still the process of translation, which then uses the information that was just stored in the messenger RNA molecule that was produced in transcription to build a polypeptide at a ribosome. All right? And once that polypeptide has been built, then you have that polypeptide, whether it's a protein in its own right or just part of a protein, you have that polypeptide. And that's why such a gene is called a protein coding gene, because the ultimate product is a protein. Now, in the slide that we're looking at, we see these two parts of gene expression, transcription and translation, shown in each of the two types of cells in the dichotomy of cell types. So a prokaryotic cell at the top, a eukaryotic cell on the bottom. And we've talked about differences between these cell types a lot of times for various reasons. But here, the difference that we started with, which is the difference with respect to having a nucleus or not, matters to gene expression. Because transcription in any cell, since it directly involves the DNA, has to occur wherever the DNA is. Translation occurs in the cytoplasm. Well, for a prokaryotic cell, the DNA, which is where transcription occurs, is in the cytoplasm, right? There is only one compartment in a prokaryotic cell. So for a prokaryotic cell, transcription and translation occur in the same compartment, the cytoplasm. Both of these parts of gene expression, transcription and translation, occur in the same compartment for a prokaryotic cell because that's the only compartment a prokaryotic cell has. A eukaryotic cell has multiple compartments, including a nucleoplasm, which is what the nucleus contains, and the cytoplasm. Well, once again, the transcription part of gene expression has to occur wherever the DNA is. But in a eukaryotic cell, the DNA is in the nucleus, so that's where transcription occurs. And translation occurs in the cytoplasm, which is a different compartment for a eukaryotic cell. Therefore, there are some differences that we'll talk about with respect to gene expression when you compare prokaryotic and eukaryotic. But it's a simpler, more direct process in a prokaryotic cell because it doesn't have these separate compartments. The details of each individual process, transcription and translation, are largely the same for both cell types, though. Now, notice that both of these words start with TRANS. So it can be easy to confuse these or remember which is which. And this is where, as I've stressed the importance of all term long, it's important to think about words' meanings outside of biology, just everyday meanings of words, because that's how they got their names. So think about transcription, which is the noun form of the verb transcribe. What does it mean to transcribe? To rewrite. Exactly. If you order a transcript of something, it's a written account of what was said, or, for instance. That's exactly why transcription in biology got its name. Right? In transcription, you're not changing a language, you're simply rewriting. Earlier I compared a protein coding gene to an instruction manual, right? And your genome, which is all of your DNA or all of any organism's DNA, is like a library containing many instruction manuals, each one of which is a gene. But libraries don't lend all of their materials, right? You're allowed to use the materials, but not all of them you can take home. There are certain reference materials that you can use while you're at the library and have to stay there, right? That's what a gene is like. Can't take it home. So to use that information, you need to write it down while you're at the library and then put the book back on the shelf. That's what transcription is. Wherever that book is, which is where the DNA is, you have to write down the information that the how-to manual is written in, and then take that written transcript with you so that you can then use those instructions to build a protein in a different part of the cell, namely at a ribosome. So that's why transcription was the name. It's rewriting the code that DNA contains in the form of a code in RNA. It doesn't change the language because you're reading in the language of nucleotides, which is what the code of DNA is. And then you're rewriting that information in the code of nucleotides in the form of RNA. It might be a dialect change, but it's not a language change. All right? So that can remind you of what comes first. You have to rewrite DNA in the form of RNA, and that's what transcription means, rewriting. Translation, on the other hand, isn't in everyday use of the word, means a change in language. And that's appropriate here because the transcript that you just wrote in transcription is in the language of nucleotides, RNA nucleotides. And you have to translate that into the language of amino acids, which is what polypeptides are built out of, right? They're not built out of nucleotides, they're built out of amino acids. So that's a language change, and that's why it's called translation. The red thing in both of these figures is called the messenger RNA transcript. The M of mRNA is messenger. And that's what gets built during transcription. It also is what gets used in translation. DNA is read, the code that's in a gene, which is DNA, gets read in the process of transcription. RNA gets written in the process of transcription. Messenger RNA, that is. Then, after transcription is done, messenger RNA gets read in the process of translation. DNA's job is done at that point. And reading that code allows for translation to create a polypeptide one amino acid at a time. In other words, the messenger RNA transcript tells the cell, and specifically the ribosome, which is the organelle of translation. It's an organelle, but it's not a membrane-bounded organelle, which is why you find it in all kinds of cells, not just eukaryotic. It's really just a molecular machine for assembling a polypeptide, but it can't do anything on its own. It has to be told what specific amino acid to add next as it makes the polypeptide longer and longer. That's what messenger RNA tells the ribosome in the process of translation. So translation actually creates the polypeptide. And all of that stuff, transcription and then translation resulting in a polypeptide, is what we call gene expression. Okay, let's go on to three now and look at the particulars. This is a good figure to reinforce what I was just talking about as far as the words themselves are concerned. Transcription doesn't change the language. You start with the language of nucleotides. Those are like the words of the language in DNA. And you rewrite that in transcription in also the language of nucleotides, but RNA nucleotides. And then you change that into the language of amino acids in the process of translation. Now the top box shows you a few genes. This is just a little bit of a DNA chromosome or a DNA in a chromosome. The entire chromosome is one enormously long double helix of DNA, right? However many there are in a species depends on that species, but this is just one of some number of chromosomes. And a single chromosome is much bigger than three genes. There are thousands of genes just on one chromosome, and there are multiple chromosomes in each of your cells. So this is a tiny stretch of DNA that you see here. A gene, though, is really just a subsequence of the overall sequence that the chromosome is. The chromosome is millions of nucleotides long. And however many millions of nucleotides there are in an overall chromosome, it's some sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's for millions of digits. All right? Therefore, when you look at a sequence, it is just nothing but A's, C's, T's, and G's. There's nothing there that says, okay, right here you have a gene starting. Well, I mean, nothing if you, as a human, were reading those A's, C's, T's, and G's. But a cell knows where the beginning of a gene is, even though a gene is not physically any different from the non-gene DNA that's right beside it. Okay? It's all sequences of A's, C's, T's, and G's, but a gene is just a subsequence within the overall bigger sequence. And what makes it its own subsequence, called a gene, is that it's enough information to produce a single messenger RNA molecule. Between genes is also sequences of A's, T's, C's, and G's, because it's all DNA. But those are so-called non-coding regions. They don't get transcribed. And it might surprise you that actually about 99% of the overall DNA sequence is not genes. It's just sequences between genes. And we still have a lot to learn about what the importance of all that DNA between the genes is. We've learned a lot, but we still have a lot to learn. We're focusing now on genes, though. And you can see a few on this chromosome, and then notice that the bottom part of the slide is just an enlargement of just a little piece of gene 1. This isn't the entire gene. But you see a little sequence of DNA. It's, of course, double-stranded, as DNA is. In the previous chapter, we focused on the other major function of DNA, which is replication, right? Here we're talking about transcription. Those are the two main jobs of DNA. But unlike replication, which we finished, in which both of the strands of DNA were important, right? Remember, in DNA replication, the strands are separated, and each strand by itself serves as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand. So in other words, in DNA replication, you use both strands. It's a little different now that we're in transcription. It still consists of two strands, a gene does, because it's DNA. But only one of the two strands is going to be used in the process. And like I've said before, to do either of these major functions that DNA has, whether it's replication or transcription, requires separating the two strands from each other temporarily. So that's going to be true here, just like it was in replication. But it's only one strand that's used, so when you separate the two, the one that's not used is just going to be there by itself unused temporarily until the two strands go back together after transcription. What were you going to ask?
So replication and transcription are like totally different processes.
And in totally different parts of the cell cycle and for totally different purposes, really. Transcription is the use of DNA during the main lifetime of a cell. When it's busy being whatever kind of cell it is, it needs transcription so that it can produce the proteins that it needs to live its life. Transcription is therefore all about the current generation. Replication is there only really for the next generation. It wouldn't be necessary for replication to occur if a cell is only going to live its own lifetime and then die. Replication is preparation for the end of one cell's life and the beginning of two new cells' lives. Okay, so the fact that there's only one of the two strands that is used in transcription means that we give them different names. The one that we use is called the template strand. You can see on this cartoon that it happens to be the top strand. But as you go down the length of this DNA and reach another gene, it's not necessarily going to be that same strand that's the template strand in the next gene. It's on a gene-by-gene basis. But for each gene, one of the two strands is the template strand, and the other one is the one that's not used. So it'll just be gotten out of the way temporarily while you read the template strand for transcription, and then when transcription's done, the two strands will go back together nicely because the DNA doesn't get changed, right? It's still going to be complementary to the other strand, and they'll form perfect hydrogen bonds between them just like they did before you separated them. Okay, now the top one here is the DNA template strand. And of course, it's DNA, so it's made up of A's, T's, C's, and G's. Transcription rewrites that using the rules of complementarity, the same rules that you used for DNA replication, except that RNA, which is what you're producing instead of DNA in this process, does not use thymine, remember. It uses uracil instead of thymine. So wherever you have an A in the DNA, where you would normally have put a T down for replication, because T is complementary to A, instead you're going to put down a U in the form of RNA. In other words, A in DNA is complementary to U in RNA, because RNA doesn't use T. But C and G still correspond to each other. And a T in DNA still corresponds to an A in RNA. Now notice that the template strand is, of course, complementary to the non-template strand of DNA, because the two strands of DNA are complementary to each other all the way down the length of the chromosome. Right? But since the template strand is being read, and since you're using complementarity rules to produce the mRNA, that means the mRNA is just like the non-template strand of DNA, except with U's instead of T's. See what I mean there? This red one is like the bottom one, which is the one that's not used, because you're reading the top one and making an RNA complementary to it. Okay, so transcription is pretty straightforward since you're dealing only with the language of nucleotides. There's how many DNA nucleotides normally? Types, I mean. Four. And there's how many types of RNA nucleotides? Four. Therefore, it's a one-to-one correspondence, meaning that a single DNA nucleotide in a gene can correspond to a single messenger RNA nucleotide. You can see that right here. Right. In other words, the messenger RNA is going to be the same number of nucleotides long as the gene is. A corresponds to U, C corresponds to G, and so on. They're the same number of nucleotides. It would be nice if, in translation, the next step after you've produced the messenger RNA, to also have a one-to-one correspondence. In other words, it would be nice if one RNA nucleotide, like this U, the first one, or the first one in that picture, corresponded to one amino acid. That's nice and simple, right? Why is it impossible, though, even though it would be nice? Why can't you have a one-to-one correspondence between RNA nucleotides and amino acids? No. That's right. Exactly. You can't specify all 20 amino acids if you only have four kinds of nucleotides. Or what I mean is you can't use just one nucleotide to specify all 20 amino acids, right? You could specify four amino acids because there are four types of nucleotides in messenger RNA. Well, that's not nearly enough. You have to be able to tell the cell to use all 20 amino acids, not just four of them. You won't make the right proteins and the cell will die if you don't specify all 20. So the simplest possibility, which would be a one-to-one correspondence, isn't possible. Therefore, the next simplest would be to use a sequence of two mRNA nucleotides. Since one isn't enough, a sequence of two you could try, right? Well, how many possible two-letter sequences are there for messenger RNA? If there's four kinds of nucleotides, how many possible two-letter sequences are there? Is that an answer? Well, let's use words.
I was scratching my head.
So it wasn't. Okay, that's the correct. That's the correct no. This means yes. How many? Anyone figure this out mathematically? Well, how many possibilities are there for a one-letter sequence? Four. And for each of those four, there's four possibilities for the second letter. Therefore, how many overall? Okay, you write down A as the first letter, right? And you have four sequences starting with A, because you can have AA, AU, AC, AG. That's what I meant when I said for each of the four in the first position, you have four possibilities in the second. Therefore, how many overall? 16. Yes, four times four. Four squared. Well, what's the problem? 16 is still fewer than 20. So the second simplest solution can't work, which is why evolution didn't let it happen. Right? 16 is fewer than 20, therefore you couldn't specify all 20 biological amino acids if you only used two nucleotides as the code. Well, what about three? How many possible three-letter mRNA sequences are there?
Is it 24?
No. You have 64, yes. Four times four times four. Four for the first. For each of those, you have four for the second. That's 16. And for each of those 16, you have four for the third. So 16 times four is 64. 64 is plenty. You only need 20, right? But 64 is the smallest number, a sequence of three nucleotides, which there are 64 possible sequences, is the smallest sequence that will uniquely specify all 20 amino acids, and therefore it's the simplest possibility, and that's exactly what natural selection favored. All right? And that's why you see here a subsequence of three nucleotides within the messenger RNA specifying as a unit one amino acid on the bottom. Tryptophan, then phenylalanine, then glycine, then serine, and so on. These are abbreviations for amino acids. Okay, it takes three RNA nucleotides to tell the ribosome tryptophan is the amino acid I need here. And that's why it's labeled this. Well, any given nucleotide sequence that is three letters long is called a triplet. That's just a general word. But a triplet in the messenger RNA gets the special word codon, because that's like one word of the language telling the ribosome one specific amino acid to use. Now, strictly speaking, the word codon should be used only to refer to triplets in the messenger RNA. But sometimes biologists, just for convenience, also talk about codons in the DNA that correspond to the codons as far as their place is concerned in the messenger RNA. It's really supposed to be messenger RNA only. Okay. The exact sequence of the amino acids is therefore specified by the messenger RNA. And when that sequence is followed and all the way through to the end, you've produced a polypeptide. That's what translation produces. All right, slide 4. Here we have an exhaustive listing of all 64 possible codons. This table is what we call the genetic code. And it's the genetic code, meaning it's not the genetic code for humans only, or the genetic code for caterpillars only, or for bacteria only. This is the universal genetic code. All organisms use this same code. And that's one of the strongest bits of evidence pointing to the fact that all organisms descended from that first original successful lineage of cells that formed the trunk of the tree of life. We all are descendants of those first cells, which is why we all use the same code. So there are 64 codons here, and the codons are shown as all cap triplets. That's the messenger RNA codon. Next, or to the right of each codon, is also a three-letter sequence, but not all caps. Those are just abbreviations for amino acids. You don't have to know those, but phenylalanine, leucine, and so on, those are amino acids. All right, now, all 64 codons are shown, but 60 of them are the lavender ones, and they specify amino acids, as you see. 4 of them, shown in green or orange, are a little different. The green one, and there's only one here, AUG is the only one, has double duty. It serves as the so-called start codon. The ribosome is the thing that is going to be reading the messenger RNA, and we'll get to that eventually. But it needs to know where to start. It needs to know what the first word is. And that's what AUG tells it. This is the beginning of where you should read the codons. And there's only one start codon. But when I said double duty, I meant that AUG also is an ordinary codon like the lavender ones because it specifies methionine as an amino acid. What this means is that all polypeptides start out with methionine as the first amino acid. Even proteins that are not supposed to have methionine as that first amino acid. And that's just because you have to have a start codon, and that start codon also happens to specify methionine. If a polypeptide is not supposed to have methionine in it, then it starts with it there because it has to, and then it will remove it later in a process called post-translational modification. But for translation, which is when it's actually built, methionine is the first amino acid. AUG functions as a start codon only once per mRNA, but there can be other AUGs in there. The same codon can be used many times. It's just that after the first AUG, any other AUG simply says methionine is here. It just operates like any of these lavender ones. Now notice there are three so-called stop codons, the orange ones. They don't do double duty. Notice that none of these three specifies an amino acid. The only thing that any of the three stop codons does is tell the ribosome, translation is over, the amino acid that you just added this last time is the last one. Now I'm telling you, you're done. Stop codons are interchangeable, meaning any one of these three can be used as a stop codon. It doesn't matter. They operate exactly the same way, even though they're different codons. Okay, now, There are two really important properties of the genetic code that I need you to understand.
Or back to what you were saying, why does there need to be three? If they're interchangeable, can there just be one?
Yeah. There could be just one for each of the amino acids, too, and there aren't. And that's part of what I'm going to be talking about. So yes, it would work that way, but there just happen to be three. For instance, when something is good, do you have to say good? You have other choices of words, right? Synonyms aren't really necessary, but they offer you a choice, right? With the same effect. So this is still part of what I'm going to be talking about here. There are two really important properties of the genetic code. One is that it is ambiguous. I mean, it is redundant, sorry. And the other is that it is not ambiguous. So we need to fully understand what these two words mean. Just in everyday language, what does redundant mean?
Not important,
no. Redundant means repetitive. Like I hear people say all the time, such and such is very unique. Meaningless phrase, really, because unique, uni means one. Unique means there is only one of that thing, whatever it is. So there aren't degrees of uniqueness. Either something is unique or it's not. Right? Or you don't have to say a very, 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 very long time. That's redundant. I did say that the genetic code is redundant. And that is simply because 64 is greater than 20. Since you have 64 codons to work with and you have to specify only 20 amino acids with those codons, that means you can have more than one codon specifying the same amino acid. And you can see this by the brackets in the genetic code. There's two separate codons here, either of which can specify phenylalanine. And notice that leucine can be specified by any of six different codons. These are like synonyms in language. There's all kinds of words you can use for good. And English has more synonyms by far than any other language because English is just a combination of a hell of a lot of different languages. So it has the biggest vocabulary because it's the vocabulary of many languages combined. And that's why you have a lot of choices of synonyms if you want to say something. You don't have to say good every time. There's a lot of different words that mean good or big, things like that. All right, so that's redundancy. And that's the direct answer to your question. That's why there are three stop codons, simply because that's the way it happened. There can be three because we have more than enough codons to work with. Okay, now the second important is that the genetic code is not ambiguous. But first, let's talk about what it means to be ambiguous. What does that mean in everyday language?
There's more than one way to do it.
That's right. Ambiguity is vagueness because there are multiple possible meanings. It's not the only way to be vague, but ambiguity is specifically vagueness due to the fact that there are multiple possible interpretations or meanings. And just a simple linguistic example of ambiguity is if I say I'm hot, that has at least four totally different meanings, maybe more. Right? It can mean that my body temperature is elevated. It can mean that I'm a currently very popular celebrity. It can mean that I'm extremely angry. Or the obvious one, I am sexually attractive. Or maybe, hot can mean probably other things as well. But those are totally different meanings, right? That's not what you would want to happen in the genetic code, because you're trying to make a very specific sequence of amino acids so that that protein will have a very specific shape and therefore perform a very specific action. You can't be confused about which amino acid goes where. Therefore, the genetic code cannot be ambiguous. If it were ambiguous, then that would mean any of these codons would specify a certain amino acid one time, and then another time it would specify a different amino acid. And that's when the cell would end up making different proteins depending on chance, basically. So, genetic code is redundant, but it is not ambiguous. Being not ambiguous, that means any given codon will specify always exactly the same amino acid every time translation occurs. All right? Let's go on to 5. Here we have two photographs that seem like they're retouched, but these are actually unretouched photographs. These organisms are actually glowing, even though neither one of them really has any natural business glowing, right? Tobacco plants don't usually glow. Pigs don't usually glow. But these ones actually are. And that's because each of these two organisms has been genetically engineered, genetically modified, meaning that an extra gene has been inserted into the organism's DNA. Slightly different origin. The tobacco plant got a gene from a firefly, or lightning bug if you prefer. The pig got a gene from a jellyfish. Well, the firefly and the jellyfish naturally glow. They produce their own light, which requires a protein. But think about what proteins are. They are the result of the cell having a specific code in the form of a gene telling the cell how to build that particular protein. There's no limit to the number of possible proteins, but any given organism can produce only the proteins that it has codes for how to build, which is why you're stuck with your proteins and therefore your traits, because your DNA is given to you from birth. All right? Well, these have been genetically modified, so they have a gene that they weren't born with that came from some other organism. And pretty drastically different organisms, right? A firefly is not very closely related to a tobacco plant, and a jellyfish is not very closely related to a pig. So the question here is, since these are pretty distantly related organisms, how does the gene work the same way it does in the natural organism when it's transplanted into a completely different organism? Why does that work? Why does a firefly gene work the same way in a tobacco plant as it works in a firefly?
Does it have to do where you're putting it? So if it's producing the firefly gene, you have to put it somewhere specific inside the cell for it to keep producing it afterwards, right?
You're not producing the firefly gene. The gene is the DNA. It's part of the cells. I'm saying you're using the gene, you're expressing the gene to produce the protein. It's the protein, like all proteins, that give you your traits, right? That the glowing comes from the protein, not from the gene. But the gene tells the cell how to build the protein. Well, in a firefly, it makes sense that the firefly gene will tell the firefly cell how to build that firefly protein. But when you put that same gene from a firefly into a tobacco plant, how does a tobacco plant know how to make the same gene, the same protein, using that foreign gene? Because of what about the genetic code? Because of its universality, exactly. It's the genetic code. So the firefly genetic code is the same as the tobacco genetic code, like I was saying earlier, or any other genetic code. All organisms use the same one. So it specifies a protein in a firefly the same way it specifies a protein in any other organism that it's put into, similarly with the jellyfish and the pig. All right, if you had a different genetic code for each species, then this wouldn't work at all, right? You'd produce a protein, but it would be totally different kind of protein because it would be used a different sequence of amino acids.
Is this kind of science behind picking traits for your babies?
Well, this is how you could, if it were ethically allowed, pick traits. Yes, by saying, I don't want this gene of my own to be passed on. I want this one from the male to be passed on, but not from me. That doesn't happen. We just leave it up to chance. But yes, that's how it actually happens by chance. You have two of each gene because you have two chromosomes of each type. One of them gets passed on. The other one stays with you. So we'll get into that too. But yes, to that extent, that's why it's like that. Okay, now let's look at the particulars of transcription, starting with 6. As you can see on the left-hand side, the process of transcription involves 3 steps, which are descriptively named: initiation, elongation, termination. Initiation just means getting it started. Elongation means making the mRNA transcript longer and longer, one RNA nucleotide at a time. And then, of course, termination means bringing it to an end. So on the top of this left column, you have the gene. It's a double-stranded DNA, but remember, only one of those 2 strands is used as the template strand. The other one's just going to be removed from that template strand temporarily. The seafoam green sequence that you see here is the so-called promoter. That's part of the DNA. And it's all A's, T's, C's, and G's, remember. It's all DNA sequence. But the promoter is a specific sequence that tells the cell this is the beginning of a gene. Because the cell has to be able to recognize where a gene starts, right? Now, the whitish kind of egg-shaped thing here is a cartoon version of the important enzyme involved in transcription, and that's called RNA polymerase. We already talked about DNA polymerase. That's used for DNA replication, right? So-called because it forms a polymer of DNA. Well, we don't want to do that here. We're not trying to build DNA. We're trying to build RNA, a polymer of RNA nucleotides. So that enzyme is called RNA polymerase. And before it does its job of adding RNA nucleotides one at a time, RNA polymerase first has to do the job of recognizing the promoter, which is the DNA sequence at the beginning, and binding to the DNA at that promoter site. That's what you see happening in initiation. And this is really what happens when we say we turn on a gene, or when we express a gene. In the process of gene expression, the first part is to turn that gene on and start reading it. Okay? That's what initiation is. Elongation means adding RNA nucleotides one at a time. So notice the 2 strands get separated from each other so that the code, the sequence in the template strand, the DNA strand that's being used, can be read, and the other one just gets ignored. RNA polymerase reads the DNA sequence one nucleotide at a time, then uses complementarity rules to add an RNA nucleotide that is complementary to the DNA nucleotide at each position, one at a time, making the RNA transcript longer and longer, which is why this part is called elongation. Think back to DNA replication. Remember that you had to have a separate enzyme called primase. What was the job of primase? Right, and what do we call that sequence of nucleotides? Keeping in mind that the enzyme's name is primase. Primer, right. Why did you have to put down a primer? Right, you can't lay down DNA onto nothing. You can only add DNA onto a sequence that's already there. Well, we don't need a primer here because we're not trying to build DNA, right? We want RNA to be the final product. So you start making RNA transcript just right away out of RNA nucleotides, which can be laid down onto nothing. Okay? Once you have one, then you just add to it. That's elongation. The RNA polymerase molecule will just move farther and farther down the length of the gene, separating the two strands as it goes. Behind it, that sequence has already been read, so the two strands just naturally go right back together because they're complementary to each other. Eventually, though, the RNA polymerase gets to the end of the gene, and that's where termination comes in. Termination tells the RNA polymerase that the job is complete. The RNA transcript is now as long as it's going to be, and it detaches from both the DNA and the RNA polymerase, and the RNA polymerase detaches from the DNA. So they're all separate pieces now, and we have a completed RNA transcript. Now, completed here means completed as far as the process of transcription is concerned. If this is a prokaryotic cell, then the RNA transcript that comes straight off of the assembly line, in a sense, is ready to go. It does not need to be modified after transcription. In other words, it can go straight to the process of translation that it's involved in. But that's not true for a eukaryotic cell. In a eukaryotic cell, the mRNA transcript that comes off the transcription assembly line has to be modified in a couple different ways that we'll talk about before it can be used in translation. We call these modifications, since they occur after transcription, post-transcriptional modifications. Okay? You don't have to bother with that extra complexity in a prokaryotic cell, but eukaryotic cells you do. Let's look at that. Well, before that, actually, let's go to 7. I forgot about this slide. This is also something that doesn't really... This applies only to eukaryotic cells, this slide 7. We talked about the promoter and the fact that the RNA polymerase has to bind to the promoter as part of initiation. In other words, to start the transcription process. But in eukaryotic cells, it's more complicated than that. Yes, the RNA polymerase does have to bind to the promoter, but usually it's not able to without some help. Help in the form of other proteins. I say other because RNA polymerase is a protein, right? It's an enzyme, therefore it's a protein. But before it can bind, RNA polymerase can bind to the promoter, other kinds of proteins first have to bind in the vicinity of the promoter to the DNA. And these other proteins are called transcription factors. Remember in the last lecture I said that we often use the word factor to describe various kinds of proteins. These are That's another use of that same word. Transcription factors, though, are proteins that bind to the promoter region and that have to bind to the promoter region in order for RNA polymerase then to be able to bind to the promoter to initiate transcription. Now, this is a lot of extra complexity, right? The question is, why would you have such complexity? Why not just have the RNA polymerase be able to bind? And the answer is that by using transcription, by requiring transcription factors, the cell can have a lot more control over whether the gene gets expressed or not. Because each little transcription factor is kind of like a switch. You have to throw a certain number of switches. Unless all switches are thrown, then the thing is not going to work. Think about what's happening here. Where do these transcription factors, like I said, are proteins? Where do they come from? Where does any protein come from? Ribosomes in the process of translation. Yes, cells produce proteins, starting out with transcription of a gene and then finally assembling that protein in the process of translation, right, at a ribosome. So each of these transcription factors has a corresponding protein-coding gene that tells the cell how to build that factor. In other words, what you have here is genes somewhere else in the DNA, in each individually coding indirectly for how to build each of these transcription factors. And then those end products, those proteins that are built, then get used to control whether other genes get turned on. See what I'm saying here?
So once it binds, does it stay there?
Not permanently, no. But it won't bind, of course, unless it is there. So what I'm saying here in this talk about the other genes is that this gene will not get expressed unless other genes have already been expressed to produce their products, which are these transcription factors. So it allows other genes to control other genes. And unless all of it is in place, then the RNA polymerase will not be able to come along and bind. So this gene will remain off until that happens. Yeah.
So is RNA polymerase 2 only in eukaryotic cells, or is it the same one in both?
I'm pretty sure it's the same in both, but I can't say absolutely for sure that it is. There might be molecular differences. It's kind of likely that there are at least some differences. But for the purposes of this, how it works, we'll say yes. And don't even bother with the two, even though there are different versions. Because in DNA polymerase, I mentioned 1 and 3. Well, those aren't the only ones. As you probably guessed, there's a 2, but ignore it for the purposes of this course. Those aren't the only ones. 1 and 3 are the important ones, though. All right, let's go to 8. And here we have an mRNA from a eukaryotic cell, but this is already been modified partially. The messenger RNA that comes directly off of the transcription assembly line in a eukaryotic cell is only the red part of this. And since in a eukaryotic cell, the mRNA that comes directly off of transcription needs to be modified post-transcriptionally, we call that immediate form of RNA that comes off of transcription pre-mRNA, because it's not yet ready to go. Pre-mRNA, we don't use that word for prokaryotes, because it is ready to go right off of transcription. So just the red sequence would be the pre-mRNA. That's what came directly off of the transcription assembly line. And you can see that it has yellow ends here. So that's part of the necessary post-transcriptional modification in eukaryotic cells. You have to add these ends. So there is the so-called 5' cap that is put onto the 5' end of the transcript. Remember, every sequence of nucleotides, whether it's DNA or RNA, and regardless of length, has a 5' end and a 3' end, as we've talked about. That goes for RNA as well. So at the 5' end of the pre-mRNA, you put the 5' cap. And at the 3' end, you put the so-called poly-A tail, which is basically a bunch of adenine RNA nucleotides. This isn't the complete set of modifications that occur post-transcriptionally in a eukaryotic cell, but this is an important one because of something I was describing in slide 2 at the beginning of today's lecture. In a eukaryotic cell, you have the extra complication of having two separate compartments in which the two parts of gene expression take place, right? Transcription occurs in the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell, and translation occurs in the cytoplasm. Well, what is between the nucleus and the cytoplasm? The nuclear envelope, right. That's a boundary between those two compartments. Therefore, for gene expression to go through both processes, transcription and translation, the mRNA transcript, which is produced in the nucleus, has to get through the nuclear envelope to get to the cytoplasm and meet up with a ribosome, which is where translation occurs. And it has to use those nuclear pores I talked about. Remember that the nuclear envelope is two layers of membrane, first of all, but every so often you have a hole in it called a nuclear pore. Well, it's not really just a hole in the phospholipid bilayer. It's a complex. Each pore is a complex of proteins arranged in a circle, forming a tunnel. And getting through that requires interaction of these ends of the mRNA transcript. So you have to put the 5' cap and the poly-A tail on in order to get this messenger RNA out of the nucleus and into the cytoplasm where it can be used for translation. That's part of eukaryotic post-transcriptional modification. Notice on this slide, I didn't mention anything about this yet, but you have UTRs. That just stands for untranslated region. Translated refers to being read in the process of translation. Well, remember I said that the ribosome has to be told where to start reading? That's what the start codon is. So everything upstream of the start codon, that AUG codon, is untranslated. Doesn't mean it's not important. It's important for docking this thing to the ribosome, as we'll see later. But this isn't read as codons. This is the first codon, then you have a sequence of codons, however long, until you get to any of the three stop codons. And that tells the ribosome exactly how many amino acids and which specific amino acids in each place to add together to make the polypeptide. You have another untranslated region and then a poly-A tail. All right, this is still not the final mRNA. This is just part of the post-transcriptional modification. In slide 9, we can see another major part. So we've already added the 5' cap and the poly-A tail. But notice that the final version, which can be called the mature mRNA, or just simply the mRNA rather than the pre-mRNA, notice it is shorter, though, than the top one, which is not yet done. And it's shorter because you have these red and pink sequences in the pre-mRNA, and the pink sequences have been taken out. So these red sequences, notice, are labeled as exons, and the pink sequences as introns. The X of the word exon refers to expression. So exons are sequences that are expressed, meaning they are going to be codons. read by the ribosome and used it in translation to build the polypeptide. The int of introns stands for intervening sequences. So they're sequences of mRNA that are not going to be used in translation because they're going to be cut out or excised. All right? So this next bit of post-transcriptional modification being shown here is that a cell has to identify where these introns are, make cuts along the way at the beginning and end of each intron, however many there are, and importantly, putting all the exons together in the right sequence end to end. So not scramble it, in other words, when you're cutting it. All right, but the introns get cut out. The exons, and only the exons, become of the translated region, only the exons become part of the mature, ready-to-go mRNA. Yeah?
So the introns exist because of the transcription factors, right?
No, that's unrelated in a sense. The transcription factors are simply proteins that are necessary for initiation of transcription. This is after transcription's already done.
So how do you know if it's like actually expressed?
Well, we're going to get to that, actually. We're going to get to a little bit of that, not too deeply in this course. But that's why I said a little bit earlier, their cell needs to be able to recognize where each intron begins and ends. And actually, that can change depending on conditions. So this is why, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself as far as the topic, but this is why, this yet another reason why one gene, one polypeptide is incorrect. Because one gene can actually end up coding for multiple different proteins if you alternatively specify where introns are. In other words, these introns are going to be cut out this time, but in a different scenario, they might be considered as exons. And therefore, you would make different proteins depending on conditions.
It's like a
code.
You just pick out the ones that are needed for that specific one.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it's efficient use of DNA, because if you wanted to have if you didn't have introns and exons, if they were only exons all the time, you'd have to have a different gene for each slightly different variation of a protein. Here you can more efficiently use the DNA, basically reusing the part that's common to all of them and just having alternatives. But like I said, I'm kind of getting ahead. Yeah.
Where do they go? Do they have a specific use somewhere else, or are they just?
They have a use as individual nucleotides. So they're once they're cut out, however long the sequences are, they are digested into individual RNA nucleotides and then reused for new RNA. So the next moment they might be in a brand new RNA transcript of a different gene. They're just part of the RNA nucleotide pool.
So is there like a term for this process of getting rid of the introns, or is it just?
Yes. It's called splicing, mRNA splicing. And that's where we'll start next time. I'll stop there.